Welcome to Power Play, on a day when the blueprint for billions to be spent on helping lower-income Canadians find affordable housing was rolled out. Coming up, we will ask the federal housing minister how this plan will actually put roofs over the heads of so many who can't afford shelter now. We'll also get a reality check from an expert who wonders if it will deliver results. Also ahead, the immigration minister might soon bar immigrants who could burden health or social services. This a new number showing only 10% of Haitian asylum seekers are being accepted into Canada. That deserves our expert reality check. We will have her shortly. And they just finished the first children's charter in Canada in a summit of youth and their leaders. We will ask them how they plan to deliver on the charter challenge. But first, it's a major $11 billion down payment on affordable housing. The federal government hopes will generate more than $40 billion in building or renovating partnerships with provinces and private investors.
Seniors will get more housing support. A mom and her kids fleeing domestic violence will have a safe, secure place to go. Those with developmental disabilities will be able to live in community-based, independent living spaces. And Canadians experiencing homelessness, including homeless veterans, will have a place to call home. Our government understands the fundamental importance of affordable housing. With it, people are healthier, communities are stronger, and families can pursue their dreams.
All right, the federal minister of families, children, and social development is Jean-Yves Duclos, and he joins us from Vancouver, where affordable housing is in chronic short supply. Minister, thanks for coming on the show. I'm curious if you could tell me, if you put this in the real world, take this strategy and put it in the real world, what kind of housing does this buy once you translate it into bricks and mortar?
Well, hello, Don, and hello, everyone. That's a very good question. In fact, it starts from today's announcement, which is the fact that the federal government is now going to be a strong housing partner for the next 10 years. This will have real impacts for hundreds of thousands of Canadians. For instance, we will be lifting out of unaffordable or inadequate housing approximately 500,000 Canadians, 500,000 vulnerable Canadians now currently living in affordable or inadequate housing will be taken out of that condition. We'll also be protecting now 400,000 vulnerable Canadians who are currently living in social housing and who are afraid of losing their home. That's not going to happen. We're going to be back and partner with provinces and territories and municipalities to make sure that the housing stock, the social housing stock, is repaired, the households are protected, and the community housing sector is built over time. We're also going to decrease by at least 50% the homeless Canadians. Homelessness is the most severe source of deprivation that someone can experience, so we're going to work in order to eliminate homelessness in the future. All of this in partnership with provinces, territories, municipalities, and the social and private sectors.
Are you sure you can get all this built? That's a big infrastructure building boom you're going to put forward in renovation. Are you confident you can deliver it in the timelines you've set out?
The answer is yes, because we have a 10-year plan. We have a very detailed strategy. And the most important reason is that we'll be partnering with so many partners across Canada that have been waiting for a long time for a renewed partnership on the part of the federal government. So they are ready. They've been waiting for us for some time. And they know how severe the housing needs are. Here in Vancouver, you've alluded to that. Now, housing is key in making people live good lives and key for making their communities thrive and grow. So it's key for all sorts of social and economic reasons.
I know that a lot of the money doesn't flow immediately. It flows after the next election. I think $3 billion flows before and the rest after, and actually goes two mandates into the future. You've got a strong economy. You've got good revenue coming in. Why not deal with this challenge in this mandate, just in case it's your last?
Well, for two reasons. First, we've reinvested strongly since 2016. In 2018, for instance, we're essentially doubling investments from the federal government in support of communities and municipalities and provinces and territories. But this we want to do over the long term, because housing is long term. It takes time to build housing. Mm-hmm. It takes time for municipalities to plan housing development, to make sure that housing is connected to transit, to early learning and childcare, education, work opportunities, healthcare and home care for our seniors. That takes time. Fortunately, the federal government is also investing and supporting investments in those other areas. But we want to do this for the long term.
I will want to go on one bit further there, because there is a lot of people that are struggling to pay rents, particularly in the city you're in right now and in Toronto. Yet you have a rent subsidy, and that doesn't really flow until 2020. You could do that right now, and that's probably when it's needed most, is right now. Are you giving people false hope, or don't you think you should jump in that market right now and help them with these rents that are out of control in some cases?
You're correct. A new innovative feature of the strategy is a new Canada housing benefit, which will start in 2020. The reason it's going to take, it's going to help 300,000 vulnerable Canadians when it is completely in place by 2017. So an average of $2,500 per year. Now, the reason it starts in 2020 is that it's going to be co-designed and delivered with provinces and territories, because we want that Canada housing benefit to be as effective as possible. But for that to happen, it needs to be developed effectively and respectfully with provinces and territories.
I'm just curious, there's a lot of talk now about making housing a basic human right. I think we couldn't argue with that, but I'm curious what that actually means. Is it like saying you have the right to pay affordable rent, or you have a right to actually have a house of some kind or a dwelling of some kind? What does that mean in real world terms?
Well, the housing right is a human right because it protects the most vulnerable Canadians, and particularly homeless Canadians. It's to make sure that the federal government assumes its share of the responsibility of ensuring that every Canadian, however difficult their lives may be, that they have access to affordable and adequate housing. So the federal government has a responsibility to assume. It's been relatively absent over the last years. So there will be a law, it will be legislated, that the federal government has to demonstrate that it's working appropriately with provinces, territories, and municipalities to make sure that every vulnerable Canadian, as I said earlier, women fleeing family violence, veterans, people with handicaps, seniors, people with severe handicaps, these people all have the opportunity, because of federal partnership, to live well and to do well in life.
Okay. Sounds like a big challenge. Thanks, Minister Duclos, for joining us. Appreciate this.
Thank you for your interest, Don, and all the best.
All right. Well, after a reality check, let's bring an eagle-eye expert on getting results from the bottom line of taxpayer investments. Former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page joins us in the studio. He's also co-chair of the Canadian Alliance to End Hopelessness. Hopelessness? Homelessness.
Homelessness.
Is this hopeless?
No, I think there's hope, actually. I think it's a real strategy, and I think when people look for strategies and they look, is there a vision? I think there's they've articulated a vision in terms of affordability and need. Is there a mission in the sense, like, do they have a plan now? Can you see, like, how the government is going to go out and address this problem of affordability and need? Yeah, and I think, like, are there, like, goals and objectives? And throughout this document, you see numbers, like 100,000 numbers in terms of on the stock, or 300,000 units that are going to be repaired, or, like, reductions in the number of chronic homelessness. So I think, like, for people like me that look for, like, can we hold them accountable? Like, they are putting these numbers in place. Are there yellow flags? There's always yellow flags when you talk about a 10-year strategy.
And you might not win the next election and the next government changes its mind.
That would be a huge yellow flag, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think when you're talking about, again, we haven't had a national housing strategy in our time. So this is new. Other countries do have one. Now we have one, so this is good. I think it has to be long-term. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to get used to 10-year plans. And, 10-year plans for housing, but, we have 10-year plans for infrastructure. We have 10, 20, 30-year plans for defense, so we should get used to that. And yeah, there's politics that will come at play. Does the government have the right definition of chronic homelessness? They have a low number. A lot of people that that I get to work with will say the number's 2-3 times higher than the number that they talk about. Mm. So it's important we get to the right starting points. And your point to the minister, why can't we bring some of this forward? Why is it going to take us 2 years in order to start moving on the National Housing Portfolio Benefit, or moving more quickly on some of these investments for the social housing stock? And I think, I'm sure, there's going to be debate. that maybe we can move some of those numbers forward. On the other hand, like yesterday, we got that report from the Auditor General, and we saw like what happens when you hit the go button too quickly, mm-hmm. Particularly with respect to the Phoenix to pay system. So it, you know, when you're dealing with you know three levels of government, a lot of nonprofit groups, it's going to take time to put this together.
I was thinking of you as I got that report. I thought Kevin Page would be having a field day. But anyway, I do want to get into how this can be done. If we get to the, some people talk about mixed use is better. The idea that you don't just create social housing buildings, uniform buildings, you have to mix it up and put social housing in with other people that are not in the social housing. Is that the way of the future? Or is it to put buildings and say, this is social housing, leave it alone, nothing else?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think the future for healthy communities is sort of, you know, mixed income diversified communities, or, you know, these are smarter communities. We've had a big debate in Ottawa about the creation of a mega shelter that's still mm-hmm. ongoing. In fact, there was a vote in city council today.
Did it go ahead or fall?
It went ahead. Yeah. Yeah, and I think to the disappointment of, I think, a lot of residents where this shelter is planned. Yeah, I mean, that debate isn't over, but I think the future definitely is in trying to get roofs over people's head. And for, you know, a lot of people that are dealing with mental illness issues, addiction mm-hmm. issues, to get them treatment at the same time. Then you, like, again, these numbers are sizable. People look about, you know, is this good for the economy? Absolutely, it's good for the economy. If you can, you know, we get these people, you know, roof over their head. Like, I couldn't imagine myself growing up in Thunder Bay not having a roof over my head. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way I would be sitting here talking to Don Martin. So you want to give as many kids and make sure that they don't experience that. And there's numbers. We know the 6,000 kids every year are going to experience like homelessness. So at some point in time, so there's a big economic cost if we don't deal with this.
Hmm. It sounds like you're giving this 1.5 thumbs up, though.
No, it's yeah. Mm. You can. I don't think it's really hard to give. It's a thumbs up for sure. Yeah. And again, you know, if you compare this effort on this file with, say, small business taxation, some of the other files, or electoral reform, this is again, you know, this is a government doing it. You know, doing a good job.
All right. Interesting. Okay. Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate your input as always.
Thank you, sir.
All right. What are your thoughts on the strategy? Is it real or rhetoric? You can reach us through social media on Facebook, through Twitter, and through Instagram. You can also contact this on this or any other topic via email. Our address is powerplay@ctvnews.ca. Well, coming up, the midweek MPs line up to defend or denounce the government. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, the midweek marvels of political acumen have gathered to give us their take on housing, a trade deal in limbo, and pipelines. Let's get started. David Lametti is a Liberal parliamentary secretary. Candace Bergen, former housing minister of the Harper government, is the Conservative House leader. Rachel Blaney, the NDP for critic, and who put forward a bill on right to housing. That's why we're going to start with you today, Rachel. Good strategy, wish list, dreams, schemes. Or do you think this is the way to go?
Well, first of all, it is disappointing in the sense of the right to housing. What we're seeing so far in this is they voted down the bill that I put forward about changing the Bill of Rights to add housing, which is a fundamental thing that so many housing advocates have been asking for mm-hmm. so long. Knowing that governments change, policy change, but a right to housing, once it's in legislation, really creates a framework that will provide a stable housing strategy moving forward. So really disappointed that I see in this proposal that they're going to again consult about what the right to housing looks like. So right there was an opportunity to send it to committee to have a meaningful conversation.
What does the right to housing look like? Is it the right to pay rent you can't afford? What is it?
Well, what it is, and basically having the right to housing means that we have to look at how we're going to make sure that people are housed. What we've seen over the last 20 years, the NDP has been very clear, been asking for some sort of strategy, asking for some substantial funding for this, because what we've seen is a decrease again and again and again of housing funding so that we can see that stability. And right now we have housing crisis, and it is not just an urban issue. This is a rural issue. I represent rural communities. You know, I had an employer call my office and say, we hired someone. It took us 8 months to get them here for the job. We held it open for them because they simply could find nowhere to live. So the housing crisis is right now. It's happening in Canada. It's very broad, the spectrum of people who are looking at housing needs. So the right to housing really means that the government has a responsibility to make sure that they're always a part of this conversation.
All right. Candace, the Conservative sort of said 10 years to do a housing strategy. They didn't. You were housing minister. Tsk, tsk, you could have done it. But is this a way to go?
Or? No, we actually always said a housing strategy, people don't need a group of people in Ottawa telling them how to fix the housing challenges. Different regions of the country have different challenges, mm-hmm. different municipalities. There are different challenges facing the country. Now, the Liberals, with a lot of fanfare, have announced a housing strategy. You will note most of it doesn't come into effect until 2020 or later, which is so typical of the Liberals. A lot of shine and glitz over here, and usually no results, and usually, in fact, what they're trying to do, bombs in the end. Mm. So I think that there's a lot of things that can be done in terms of housing. Homelessness, for example, is a very different challenge than people who need more affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So their challenges, usually it's addiction and mental illness, people who are struggling with homelessness. We introduced and implemented something called Housing First, which has been a huge success. In fact, we talked a little bit about it 2 weeks ago when we talked about the fact that veterans in the last 2 years, their homelessness percentage has gone through the roof, yeah, which is heartbreaking. True. So I think that there are a lot of solutions that can be had. I think certainly funding and letting provinces make decisions is a really important part of it. Municipalities and cities have a huge impact on the type of housing and what's available. But then helping people with addictions and mental illness is more the approach on homelessness.
So David, you got some critics. Why wait so long to really kick this thing into high gear? And why not declare the right to a home now? Why consult on it?
Well, Don, we effectively are implementing a program, a very good program, that's based on effectively the right to housing. The UN Special Rapporteur came out today and mm-hmm. said this is a huge step, mm-hmm. a huge step. You just heard Kevin Page, who was generally favorable. It takes time. This is a massive program. It's a problem. We realize there's a real housing need in Canada, and we're going to fix it. We're committing $40 billion over 10 years. But it takes time to implement these things carefully, particularly because, as Candace states, we're going to work with the provinces, we're going to work with municipalities, and we're going to work with other groups such as co-ops and that sort of mm-hmm. thing in order to get this right. And it also is tailored to be applied across the country, not just in urban settings, but in rural settings. We're talking not only about building social housing, 100,000 units that we'd like to see, but also increasing the stock and improving the stock of available housing. Again, fixing or bettering 300,000 properties across Canada.
I guess I'm curious one thing, if I could, on an ideological thing. Should the federal government be in the social housing business, or should it just give the money to
this is funny. So when we were in government, I remember Adam Vaughan and the Liberals criticizing us day after day after day for not renewing agreements on social housing.
Right.
These were agreements that had stopped being renewed under past Liberal governments and then current Conservative governments, because our belief was give the money to the provinces, let the provinces work with different housing providers. Mm-hmm. I noticed there's no announcement to renew the co-op, the social housing agreements after
it's
all
there.
The...
I think it's in there.
It's there. It's
I've
in there.
It.
Yeah,
it's
no,
there.
No. So
it's in there.
Now you're doing what we it's did, whereby the provinces can continue. So I know this.
Oh, okay.
Can continue
yeah,
to supplement.
We're giving money to continue the co-op.
You're not renewing the agreements.
Rachel,
you're renewing the agreements.
I think it's really important to say what we heard was $40 billion. That is not what this government is promising. What they're saying is they're going to work towards that with provinces and private. So let's just be really clear. The other reality is 90% of that funding isn't coming until after 2019, and there will be no report to Parliament until 2020. So, you know, housing is a core need. This is a crisis across this country. It has been way too long. There's need for federal leadership, absolutely, because federal leadership is important because it's looking at the country as a whole and providing the information and then the funding to make sure that those houses are there. And so, you know, what we're hoping to see is an actual partnership with provinces. Mm-hmm. We know that municipalities have been doing a lot of work on this front. A lot of those municipalities are ready. They're on the ground. They've been preparing for years.
Sure
and they want to just get this going, because the reality is they have everybody coming to their door saying, we desperately need home help.
I have to say, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities is in town today, and
yes,
they're pretty praising this.
They're
praising this thing. They're happy with this.
it takes time to implement these things, but it's also true that we've already started since we've been elected to put more money back into social housing. So it's not as if the money is starting to flow tomorrow.
Well,
we're back, and we do need need federal leadership here. We have programs targeting
all sorts.
Don't say the child benefit.
Yes. I'm not going to say the child benefit, even though that's an important part of the picture.
But it's interesting. I met with FCM representatives today, and on things like infrastructure, they're still saying you've announced a lot of money, where's the money? And I think there is a real legitimate concern around Liberals making announcements, but it actually not being delivered.
It takes time
on infrastructure funding, we got the money directly immediately to municipalities.
I'm going to get a little bell and start banging
the bell.
I do want to move on because I got a couple other topics. There's other things happening. The Business Council of Canada came out today. I thought it was kind of interesting. They are saying to the Trudeau government, look, don't lollygag around on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Trudeau didn't show up for a meeting to sort of sign off on an agreement in principle. We need this now. And I guess, Candace, I get your thoughts on this. How urgent is the TPP? What do we rush into it, or do we hold back and make sure we're getting the best deal? Or do you think we're getting the best deal?
Well, again, the devil is in the details. Mm-hmm. I know the deal that our government negotiated and worked on was a good deal. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing from sectors, agriculture, pork, different sectors that are primarily mm-hmm. my riding, they want TPP. And I think there is some concern. We're not really understanding what the government's position. When you have a prime minister that doesn't show up for an important meeting, nobody really knows what happened. What's he holding back on? Mm-hmm. And I think the other message that we want to ensure the government is clear on is we need NAFTA and we need TPP.
Right.
It's not an either or, but these are important trade agreements that sectors are looking at in order to get access to more customers.
I think the NDP has some concern with TPP as it was originally presented.
Yeah.
Are you supporting what Trudeau did and say, let's just hold back and...
Well, you know, the concern here from both the Conservative government and the now current Liberal government is how much of this is being done in secret, and we don't know what's going to happen. We know a lot of experts have said up to 58,000 jobs could mm-hmm. be lost across the country. There's a lot of sectors that are not feeling like they're included in the process because it is so secretive. And we know that when the committee went around Canada, you know, about 90% of the people that came in there said, look, we're really against this and we have a lot of serious concerns. So, you know, we're hoping that those concerns will actually be addressed and that this secretiveness will be more open.
David, you've been very patient.
Don, you'll recall that I spent over a year as Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of International Trade, and I led consultations from coast to coast to coast on the TPP. I met with all sorts of stakeholders. And what we've done is taken quite a responsible approach. Yes, we heard the agricultural sector, beef, pork, and we know that they're strongly in favor of an agreement. But we also heard very serious reservations on the IP sections of the agreement, for example, and the fact that it wasn't green enough, it wasn't progressive enough. And that came out in our consultations across the country. I heard that so many times. So we took a very responsible approach to the new reality of the United States being out of the picture. And we have used that. We're at the table. We're continuing to negotiate. We're moving forward with an agreement that represents our values and obviously is trying to meet the needs of certain sectors that really would like to see mm-hmm. the TPP, mm-hmm. but also is true to our values. We're not going to sign any agreement, but we're working hard to get a good agreement at that table, to get the right agreement for Canada. And we're working hard at the NAFTA table too.
All right. Very quickly, Rachel Notley was in that chair yesterday saying the federal government has to do more to help push that pipeline through the Trans Mountain one through to the coast. Is the federal government falling down on the job, Candace?
100%. Their policy killed Energy East. There's absolutely no doubt about that. They have introduced regulations and very, very difficult competitive things that make Canada less competitive and make it not a smart idea at this point to build a pipeline. So, the Liberals have failed. They have not followed through on any commitment. In fact, the only thing that they've done when it comes to pipelines is made it more difficult and killed Energy East.
I don't suppose you want the federal government to get behind this pipeline more.
Well, you know, I just have to say how much I respect the work that Rachel Notley has done around climate change in her province.
An NDP premier.
It's an important thing because I think the reason that we have so much concern around pipelines is specifically because we still have a government that's pushing through Harper's targets in terms of climate change. We've seen absolutely no change. change in that. All the experts are letting us know that we're not even going to meet those targets. Okay. So Canadians want to see some real action here. They're not seeing it. They have massive concerns, and that's why we're seeing. And it's still the same botched approach, right?
All right,
David, it hasn't changed.
Brief answer.
We've had a responsible approach on pipelines that respects economic concerns and the environment. We established a set of criteria. We've approved pipelines under those criteria, like Trans Mountain, like Line 3. We've done far more on pipelines than the previous Conservative government did in 10 years.
Those are fighting words.
We're going to keep moving.
Thank you all for coming in. We got through three topics.
We get along so well.
I know.
And then you start on pipelines.
You started right at the end. All right. Thank you all. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Don.
Just ahead, Canada breaks for a wave of Haitian immigration, but rejections of their asylum claims are piling up. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, with a Haitian wave of immigrants in the forecast, a steep decline in asylum approvals, and a potential change to rules over the social or healthcare costs of allowing immigrants in, well, add that up, and it's time for our expert eye on the file to weigh in. Immigration lawyer Chantal Deloge joins us from Toronto. Chantal, our friend Stephanie Levitz at Canadian Press found these statistics today, and it shows that the Immigration Department is allowing only 1 in 10 Haitian asylum seekers to be granted asylum. That's down from 43% just a few months ago. Should we be putting that on a billboard somewhere close to the border crossing, and would that serve as a deterrent as these Haitians flee Donald Trump's deportations?
I do think it's important to disseminate that kind of realistic information to people who might be looking to seek asylum here. But I also think that it's important not to necessarily get distracted by statistics, because every claimant is assessed on their own merits. And whether the acceptance rate for people from your country is 10% or whether it's 90%, that's not necessarily an indicator that you would be accepted or rejected personally. But I do think it would be a good idea to advertise these kinds of rates to people so that they can think seriously before making that leap.
How many do you think we should be bracing for? Because assuming they won't get this message somehow, are we really going to face a lot of Haitians fleeing the United States because of this change in the rules?
It's very difficult to say. Law of averages and past behavior indicates that certainly some of them will make that decision to come to Canada. But at the same time, as they, the ones that have stayed back and not come to Canada already are probably hanging back with the idea that they're going to watch and see what happens with their compatriots that have come and tested our system. So they're going to start seeing that it's not necessarily a free ticket to Canada. They will want to think more seriously. And I have to think that those who have hung back and have been a little bit more conservative will probably think twice.
Why do you think that it's gone from over 40% down to just 10%? Are we getting badder apples coming in now and we're okay before? What's the reason for that, do you think?
I've been wondering about that, too, and I think it may be a function of two things. First of all, the Refugee Board can easily hear very strong cases very quickly and push them through the system with a minimum of effort and time. So it could be that simply that the cream has floated to the top and that the board has just skimmed it off, and the initial numbers were quite high. And now they're working their way through the more difficult or more questionable cases. It could also be that the people with the highest degree of fear of returning to Haiti have been the first ones to flee and come to Canada. That may also be the case.
All right. I'm curious, you were at a parliamentary committee yesterday here in Ottawa. I noticed you avoided coming on PowerPoint yesterday. But anyway, today I found it interesting. The immigration minister said he's thinking of rule changes to curb immigration based on the demands that they would place on medicinal or social services. You seem to be saying the rules that exist are fine, they just need to be enforced. What's the story here?
Yeah, so people are really conflicted about this. It's a serious policy decision because the way that the law is now is that it excludes potential immigrants who have an illness or a disability which could cause expenses to our public health care system in Canada, which are more than the average healthy person would use in Canada. There is a pretty strong argument on one side to say that, you know, that it might be discriminatory and we shouldn't take such a closed-minded view towards people who have illnesses and disabilities because they contribute so much to our society. There's another side of the argument that says that, look, this is about taxpayer dollars at the end of the day. Our health costs in Canada are already high. people already pay a lot of tax? And is it fair to allow people to come in and add a further burden to that system, which is already expensive? And it's not only to do with cost, it's also to do with availability of services. You know, if it was your mother on a heart transplant list, how would you feel if someone was coming in who needed a heart transplant and maybe supplanted her on that list? So there's a lot of policy decisions to be made here, and it's a tough, tough, tough call.
I saw you use one example, though, of a person that needed certain kind of drugs, and the person that was doing the assessment overinflated the cost of those drugs and made it look like he shouldn't be staying here and sent him back.
Yeah, well, that's the other problem, is that the way that the system is being run now, I personally don't think there's a problem with the actual law. I think the problem is the officers aren't applying it correctly. If they would cost it out and look at all the relevant factors, you would find that a lot less people are excluded than currently is the case.
All right. Chantal, always a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, today's summit on the Children Delivered Chartered Protection for Children. We'll find out what that means after these messages. Please stay with us. Welcome back, youth. Representatives and their leaders have just wrapped up a summit this afternoon to craft Canada's first children's charter. Let's find out what that's all about. I'm joined by Sarah Austin, the founding director of Children First Canada, and youth representative Hannah Ruth. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
This is kind of exciting. What does it mean, though, Sarah?
The Canadian Children's Charter is really bringing together the rights of Canada's children that were enshrined in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child more than 25 years ago, and looking at the concrete gaps that exist for kids in our country. We have 6 million kids living in Canada, and far too many of them are falling behind. They're facing child poverty, abuse and neglect. They're struggling with the most basic things like access to adequate housing and food. Far too many kids go to school hungry every day. So the Children's Charter really brings to life children's rights, identifies the significant gaps that kids in our country are facing, and puts together a plan of action for, you know, how we actually make Canada the best place in the world for kids to grow up.
Okay, so you're going to take it from abstract to action. How does that happen? You need these guys inside the government, right?
We need our government, absolutely. We need our parliamentarians to put together laws and policies that make concrete investments into the lives of children. But we also need all Canadians. We need civil society organizations who work on the front lines with children. Our partners like Kids Help Phone and Boys and Girls Clubs, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, children's hospitals across the country. We also need the private sector, you know, corporations that are investing in children, like TELUS, KPMG, and TD, and many others who are making concrete investments. And we need parents. We need children themselves speaking up about the issues that matter to them. And we need every Canadian working to make this plan an action for every child.
All right, Hannah, why do you and your demographic need this charter, and what's your priorities for it?
Well, we need this charter because our children are falling behind. Now, I'm 18 now, and throughout my entire childhood, I grew up with some kids. I went to kindergarten to grade 12 school, and you could see where children fell behind. Now, children who were marginalized in different race groups, you could see that sometimes that impacted them, and they fell behind. Children who grew up in poverty, they, for instance, have a less percentage chance going to post-secondary school. Those children didn't necessarily get the same nutrition when starting school, and then their detention decreased in class. All these things end up adding up. And one of the most concerning things to me was accessible health care. The children who may have had disabilities or cancer or other life-threatening diseases were taken out of school for such a long time. And I'm from Windsor, Ontario, so it's like 4.5 hours to get to sick kids. And by the time you get there, the parents most of the time end up having to quit their jobs. And then that just starts a cycle of poverty. And, you know, kids really deserve that chance to be in school. And the parents, they want to support them as well. So having accessible health care in each and every community is so important.
What's different in this charter than, Sarah, from, say, the UN Convention? Like, that's a very general but blanket document. Does this just lift from that, or is it different?
It's absolutely based on the rights of children that are protected under international law and under Canadian law, but it really also helps to put a spotlight on where are we falling furthest behind? What are the urgent issues that are facing Canadian children and youth right now? And hearing directly from children themselves, young people like Hannah and dozens more who were at the summit and hundreds more across the country from coast to coast to coast have helped to create this. This has really been shaped by the voices of children and youth and their daily experiences of what it's like to struggle to grow up in our country. Now, Canadians have a myth that this is one of the best places to raise a child, but it's far from that. Canada ranks 25th out of 41 nations for the well-being of children, according to UNICEF's child well-being scorecard. We are so far behind, and we really need to raise the awareness of all Canadians that we can and we must do better.
I mean, the charter's literally just been released minutes ago. What do you want next, Hannah? What's the step you want to take this thing towards some sort of implementation?
Well, I want civil society, the government, and like all Canadians to come together and embrace this, use this as a call to action and come forth and make Canada a better place for children to grow up. There's no reason why one in five children should live in poverty in Canada when Canada is the fifth most prosperous country in the world. I think it's ridiculous.
Yes, I agree. All right, let's see if this thing can put words into action. Thank you both for coming in. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, freedom of speech is cast off at least one ivory tower. Please stay with us. All right, it's time for the wonderful and sometimes wacky Wednesday pair of exemplary journalists. Let's get right to them. Susan Delacorte writes for iPolitics and the Toronto Star. Jotelyne Bellavance is bureau chief for La Presse. A bit of a curious opening to question period today. Here's Andrew Scheer's question.
Will the Prime Minister join me in condemning the egregious crackdown on free speech at Laurier University?
Our government is committed to creating open spaces for Canadians to debate and express their views. In a free society, we may disagree with the person's views, but we must defend their right to hold them, unless those views promote hate. Intolerance and hate have no place in Canadian society or in our post-secondary institutions. We will continue to fight to ensure the charter rights of Canadians are upheld and that every Canadian can feel safe and secure in their community.
All right, just give you a little background on that. Freedom of speech debate is raging after tutorial assistant Lindsay Shepherd at Wilfrid Laurier University was berated for showing a short segment from an interview with an alt-right professor named Jordan Peterson. He refuses to use gender-neutral pronouns, and she was having a discussion about that in her class. She taped the Inquisition with the other professors, and now there was a big outcry, and the university has apologized. So it's interesting, this issue, because Andrew Scheer, remember, he was during the leadership, he said, I'm going to cut funding off the university that don't allow freedom of speech. He seems to be embracing it now. What do you make of all this?
It is a really, really interesting story, and it's got people talking, too. This is happening more and more often on campuses. It was strange to bring it up in question period.
Yeah. First question, too.
Yes, yeah. Because they have apologized. It is kind of over. Down there, you know, people have all apologized. She's not in trouble anymore. In fact, they've even said they regret the remarks they said to her. So this, as you say, is about something else. But it is an interesting issue. I think it's happening more and more on campuses. If I can plug another column, Paul Adams has a really good column in iPolitics. Yeah, Paul is a journalist, but also a professor at Carleton University, and he's written just, I think, the definitive piece on this.
So she's basically a hero for doing
this. She is
this.
A hero for doing the tutorial assistant. Yes.
Yeah, the tutorial assistant, not the people. But I mean, the guy actually went so far as to sort of talk about this guy is Hitler-esque, you know. It was, really, it was completely over the top at one time. Go ahead, JD.
Yes, and, you know, university campuses are supposed to be the place where debates of ideas take place fully and are encouraged. And if you have some kinds of events like this, this may discourage the debate of ideas, and it's not good for universities and students who go to those universities. So I think we have to encourage freedom of speech, freedom of association, obviously, but also freedom to express those ideas, even if they might be controversial. There are limits that are imposed on this, and you know, if there's somebody goes overboard, there will be consequences. But you have to allow freedom of speech.
Yeah, but, I mean, give your head a shake on this thing. I don't take these apologies very seriously because they're done under extreme duress. Mm. I listen to the, if you can find it on the internet, I recommend the viewers listen to the taping of this, because they were coming down on her saying, you know, you're offending students, you're making a toxic environment. And this is a fairly innocuous discussion. This was broadcast on a television show throughout Ontario.
Yeah, the reason that the right gets so whipped up about this is because it's happening a lot on the left at the moment too, yeah. Which is, you know, everything is now an offense. There's yeah. People are taking offense at things. I'm not even going to start it because I know I'm going to get trouble myself. But it is the reason that Andrew Scheer has started it is because people on the right are now having a huge conversation about this. Mm-hmm. The problem is that it. Freedom of speech is often a way of racists or xenophobes or anti-immigration mm-hmm. people to portray what they want to say too. This was not in that category, mm-hmm. but that's where the conversation is.
Okay, I want to move on because this is one right up JD's alley, I think. Transport Canada directive is coming into force next week. It will allow small knife blades and small scissors, but the Bloc Québécois sees a different threat in that. It thinks Trudeau's sacrificing the safety of passengers to accommodate religion by allowing the wearing of kerpens on planes. And Minister Mark Garneau says that's all hogwash. But do you believe this is a strategy the Bloc's trying to use? And will it work?
Yes. Well, I don't think it will work. It might work because the Bloc managed to get the National Assembly to adopt a motion today calling on the federal government to go back to the old policies on allowing those knives. But clearly the Bloc Québécois is in a disparate situation. They're trying to whip up the identity politics in Quebec,
right.
And they're doing it the wrong way because Ottawa is just trying to harmonize their regulations with other countries who are now allowing those knives to be used on board or be right. transported on board. So somebody was telling me this morning, if you knit, you know, the airplanes, yeah. Before these rules were changed, you had to cut the la laine with your teeth because you couldn't use a scissors.
That's
so he was like, well, yes, exactly. So
linen?
Thank you for helping.
Obviously,
me.
You don't knit very often
no,
if you're using linen.
Not at all. So you needed to use your teeth to cut it. So it was ridiculous. And also at the airports, CATSA officials were seizing a lot of little knives for nothing.
And nail clippers, basically.
And nail clippers. So they were like, I think a lot of little knives, like 15,000 a month. So it was getting ridiculous taking their times, and that's why Mr. Garneau and the government moved on this file. So the Bloc Québécois, desperate situation, calls for desperate measures and not very, very eloquent for
I
for
want to make
party.
Sure I'm correct about this, but does not Jagmeet Singh carry a kerpen
mm-hmm.
as
yes,
well?
Yes.
So that's, yeah, I think we see a bit of, there's where some politics are too. This has been the open question, is the kind of politics we've seen in Quebec, the identity politics, mm-hmm. which are a little more whipped up there, let's just say, again, this is like the risky topic panel.
That's how we put you on it.
But yeah, I think that's the Bloc saying this is a tiny little message to the new NDP leader as well.
It's a risky proposal for the Bloc Québécois because young people are not there at all. Young people in Quebec have friends who are part of those communities.
Right.
So they don't care about what the Bloc is saying on that file. But clearly in the outskirts of Montreal and the regions, rural regions, they may try to whip up their support, but I don't think it's going to work.
I like all your columns, but I like the one you did today or yesterday, looking at the Auditor General report and basically saying it's a fail on deliverology. That was the theme. I didn't really get to it with the Auditor General, but that was it. You're not delivering results.
Yeah, I noticed Stephanie Levitz, our good friend, picked up on that in the press conference too. She said, what about deliverology? That was my question as well. I thought the
deliverology, just so everyone knows,
yes, yes.
What does it mean?
What is
something
deliverology?
The Trudeau government's embraced.
You don't have to worry about it
okay,
anymore. Yeah.
It's dead.
deliverology is a theory, and they actually, not to make fun of it, no. They actually did believe in that governments are too often measure their progress by how much effort they put into things rather than what results you see at
right.
the end. And so this was the whole philosophy of this government. And the Auditor General couldn't have been more clear yesterday, mm. couldn't have been more clear saying this government doesn't focus on results for citizens. So I'm like, what happened to that? Mm. What happened to deliverology?
You cannot have a better neutral assessment of this than from the Auditor General. It's not a political party who's speaking. Right. It's the Auditor General, the office, which is respected across Canada, to give us the exact assessment of a situation that deals with the government.
Is this a failure of the bureaucracy, or is it a failure for the PMO to do it? I'm just wondering if, because he did say, you know, the trouble with this whole monolithic government is it's focused on inward looking good rather than on results driven looking, servicing the taxpayers.
On election day, the Canadian will not vote to change the bureaucracy. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if they blame the bureaucracy or the government. It's going to be the government who will be accountable on election day. So
it would be interesting to see if Harper had won the election, if Conservatives were still in power, whether Phoenix would be the mess that it is. Mm-hmm. I think it would be. Mm-hmm. Whether Revenue Canada would be the mess that it is. That is a huge mess.
CRA was the big story in some ways.
I can't remember seeing anything that bad in an Auditor General's report.
Since the Sheila Fraser, they broke every rule.
This is a lot of Canadians getting wrong information about their taxes. You know, like, it was pretty bad.
Taxation, they have a problem. All the tax narratives fit together, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Big time.
You pointed that out in your column.
The NDP was having some fun with that, too, is, you know, Canadians can't get through on the phone, but Stephen Bromptman can get the Prime Minister, right?
To clear him.
Did they clear, yes.
One day later, here's his explanation. I'm sure he's good. Pretty amazing Auditor General. How's his French, by the way? Is that coming
back? Perfect. I give him 10 out of 10. And it's great because it means that it's possible.
All right. Thank you. Well, you learned French or English. Anyway, thank you all. I never learned French. Thank you all. All right. We'll see you next week. That is the show for today. Scott Laurie standing by with the very latest news headlines. We'll leave you now with the Prime Minister sporting a slightly waxy complexion. Actually, it's all wax because that's Justin Trudeau's just unveiled wax doppelganger at the Gravelin Museum in Montreal. It's a little weird, isn't it? All right. And tomorrow, we're back. Same time, same channel, very different power plays in Canada and around the world. Thanks so much for watching. Ooh, that's a little spooky.